Blog Talk Radio.
Hey guys, it's a Sunday night edition of Movie Geeks United. Hope everyone out there is having a good one.
I'm having a good one.
Are you having a good one, man?
I'm having a great one. I didn't know we were introducing this as a special Sunday night edition.
Well, or Monday or Tuesday, whatever you're listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
It's certain to be a special one.
It's going to be a good one.
Special edition. So how have things been going? You did you go to the movies this weekend?
I went to see a couple things, but I think the big standout is obviously District 9, which is worth all its hype,
yeah.
Worth all its good reviews, and the anime on Ponyo.
Oh, you did see that?
Oh, dude, it's magical to say the least. It's a wonderful film, but those two, I'm really, you know, those are really good. I can't recommend them enough.
And the director of Ponyo, what did he do previously?
He did Spirited Away, Howl's
right.
Moving Castle, a lot of great anime films, and this one, you know, because, you know, it's weird because I'm conflicted because, you know, I think Spirited Away I saw in Los Angeles, it was subtitled, it wasn't dubbed, but Howl's Moving Castle and this one are obviously dubbed with famous voices, and there is something about the hearing Liam Neeson and Cate Blanchett in this recent one that adds, I know it's blasphemy to say this, but it adds to this magical element of the film that it's, you know, their voices and the characters they play, but it's just, there's just something really wonderful about it. And it's a really great, not only children's film, but just for everyone. It's not insulting, like, you know, it's just wonderful.
So do you see this picture possibly giving something like Up a run for its money in the best animated?
No. It's just not. It doesn't. The way the Up, what Pixar did with this and with WALL-E last year, they really have cornered the market. But Ponyo is definitely, I mean, Up, not no pun intended, is up there with it. But I think Up is really in a class by itself as far as at least American-made films. But the gentleman who made this film, the Japanese gentleman, is someone I grew up with all my life with a lot of TV shows and everything. It's a very magical film, and it's a weird, in a weird way, the antithesis of the documentary I saw last week, The Cove, about what the Japanese do with the dolphins and everything. And it's, you know, a double feature of these two things. And I don't mean that to be my usual sarcastic, cynical self, but it's very interesting that last week's documentary is very important and very disturbing. And then you have this week's film, which is a very life-affirming.
Yeah, sure.
And it's a very interesting contrast.
I did see The Cove, too.
What did you think of that? Were you also just, like, really disturbed in the last half hour?
No, it is disturbing. And The Cove, of course, is about the kind of popularization of dolphins as in many facets, how they're treated, and apparently their extermination island is located in Japan.
Right, yeah.
Hundreds of thousands upon thousands of dolphins are killed and sold and then given to theme parks. And
yeah, it's
about how that's not conducive to the way dolphins are supposed to exist.
Yeah, or any living creature is supposed to exist, because, you know, I'm watching this thing and, you know, we're thinking about all these things that we're supposed to do to about global warming, about the environment, and it's like this film and the practices that are being shown in this film, wow, this puts us back a good, like, 30, 40 years. And it's just about the mercury levels alone in the fish.
Yeah, right, right.
And that really threw me off. I'm like, I thought, you know, all the seafood that we're eating, supposedly that's supposed to be good for you, it's all tainted.
Mm-hmm.
That was another thing. Not the, excluding the whole thing about the dolphins. Forget. That's just an incredibly horrendous part of the film. But
yeah. I mean, it's enough to make you bow out of your Broadway debut.
You are a funny man, Jamie DeMille. And you, thank God you did not bring that up on that interview.
I know. Okay, let's talk about all this stuff and more a little bit later. Let's get to our interview first, and I think we're going to be joined by Chris on the other side of this interview.
Okay.
Michael Dana, a great composer. People in the know recognize the name automatically for a long-time collaboration he's had with director Adam Egoyan, Exotica, and all these great films that he's behind. And Michael has a really colorful, rich career. Movies like Girl Interrupted, Bounce, The Guys, Capote. He's worked with Gilliam on Tideland and his upcoming film, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which is Heath Ledger's last film. Little Miss Sunshine, and then he can do something like 500 Days of Summer and Surf's Up, I believe. Surf's Up.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing the range that he has. I mean, it's just really incredible.
Yeah, he's terrific. And he talked to us a lot about the craft of film composition, and I think you guys are going to enjoy this interview. Here's Michael Dana.
It's maybe a cliche, but, I mean, it really was the first thing I wanted to be when I was a little kid. I you know, my dad was a singer, and, you know, I just remember hearing things when I was, you know, some of my earliest memories sitting and listening to him sing and just thinking, not that I wanted to be a singer at all. I never did for a second, but I just wanted to know who it was that, you know, wrote the notes on the page, and that really never changed.
Was it rock or pop or jazz that you were particularly influenced by at a young age, or was
it's
mix?
It's interesting, now that I have a young son myself, it's interesting to watch how people just gravitate, you know, and like I said, it's not so much what other people are doing, but you just kind of gravitate. I mean, my dad loved, you know, opera and jazz, as a matter of fact, and I have, you know, I mean, I don't really have any interest. I mean, that jazz is like maybe the one kind of music that I really don't have an affinity and an interest in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not so much what you're exposed to. You know, what I'm saying is it doesn't matter how much, you know, Bach I play for my kid, if he doesn't, you know, if he wants to hear, you know, Huey Lewis in the News, then that's kind of what he's going to gravitate towards. It's
sure.
Just interesting what, you know, but when I was a little kid, I gravitated towards, you know, Baroque music, strangely enough, and then, you know, I grew up in a time of the progressive rock movement, and that was, you know, a very exciting combination of things that I was interested in: folk music, classical music, and you know, as well as rock and roll,
mm-hmm.
and all those things came together with electronics, which was also something that I was really interested in, and so that you know, I played in bands when I was a teenager, but you know, by the time I was, you know, later on in my teens, I wanted to study composition at university, and that's what I ended up doing.
That was in Toronto?
Yeah.
And you composed for the theater there, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Well, when I was an undergraduate, I was interested in, you know, just kind of doing anything to do with writing music. I wanted to write music, and yet I also wanted to get paid to write music. I mean, that's kind of a practical sideline that, you know, a lot of my fellow students weren't that interested in. So, you know, it was a matter of looking around at the world and what it was that, you know, where were composers needed. And yeah, I volunteered at the theater on campus, and I did sound effects and music for them, and you know, that was one of the many things that I did. But while I was doing that, I met you know, another undergraduate who was writing plays and having them performed, and you know, that was Atta McGoyan, and then he went on to make films,
yes,
of course,
mm-hmm.
And you know, yeah. So really, you know, it was kind of just serendipity that we, you know, happened to meet, and neither of us was all that interested in film. You know, that's not why I became a composer at all.
Right.
I was never interested in film music when I was growing up. I wasn't really that interested in film, period. And neither was he. He was interested in theater and writing and stand-up comedy, strangely enough, which surprised people given
him. Yeah, I would never have guessed that with him. And I just watched Adoration a couple of months ago, so I wouldn't have guessed that. Okay.
Well, he's an extremely funny person in a very, very dark and dry way, and I think he would have been way too far ahead of his time as a stand-up
comedian. You know, he would have been. I mean, it's good to know, though. That's good to know, someone, because the films are so serious in that regard, at least.
Well,
it's good to know that he does have that sense of humor.
He does, and if you sit with Adam and watch one of his films that other people, you know, are, and obviously he's a very serious and a very brilliant, you know, intellectual, but he finds a lot of things hilariously funny in his films that I think other people would find it very enlightening to sit beside him while he's watching one of his films.
I would have loved to have sat beside him for the last one, Adoration, just because I found that a fascinating film, and it wasn't at all what I expected from the trailer.
Yeah.
It's one thing, and when you're watching it unfold, it's the trailer. I personally find the trailer very misleading.
Yeah.
But the film itself is just downright fascinating.
Yeah.
And his use of time, his use of structure, how he tells a story is, I have never seen anything like it, starting with, for me at least, when I first watched Exotica and so on. You know, it's just amazing.
It's something that I think it's been, for a composer, he's been an amazing collaborator, and his work has been something that really brings out the best in a composer, and that you know, he does tell his stories, you know, in a different way. Obviously, we're used to narrative film where, you know, there's a beginning, middle, and end, and time, you follow a timeline. But for Adam, you know, things, the timeline is not necessarily the thing that links the film together. It might
right.
be an emotional line or a thematic line that, and then therefore the music has a bigger role to play, in a sense, in drawing things together, in keeping an emotional continuity, and in you know, explaining kind of underlying. I mean, there's so much suppression, in a sense, in many of his characters. They're often damaged.
Mm-hmm.
They have mysterious outward manifestations of things that we don't really understand. We
right.
know that they're acting strangely, but we don't really know why. And there's something hidden, which, you know, the music has the ability to expose and to, you know, basically work on that level. And that's really that's an amazing place for a composer to get to play.
Okay.
Well, I'm curious, because your collaborations with him, they've been so successful, and that you've had numerous collaborations with him. What clicks between the two of you? It's my first part of the question, and do you find a benefit in working with the same director multiple times?
Well, the second question first. Yeah, it's an amazing experience, and I wish every composer could have that experience of working with a composer director collaborations in repeated ways, because you really are able to get. You know, the first film that you work on a director, no matter how simpatico you are out of the gate, there's still a huge learning curve, and there's a trust curve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the director's been working on this film for 2 years or so, and they have, you know, obviously a great deal of, you know, tied up in the film in every way. And you know, for them to... And they're directors. I mean, they want to direct, and they want to have control over what it is that they're trying to say, and to hand over such an emotionally valuable part of the film over to somebody else in a way that is a language that they don't necessarily speak, it's an incredible leap of faith. And you have to, as a composer, you have to understand that a lot of the a lot of the situations that you end up in are just simply that, and you have to be compassionate about the situation that they're coming from, and so you spend much of the first film just kind of getting that trust and gaining that trust. And once you've written a score for a film and it becomes their score too, of course, because it's a collaboration. And once you've crossed that bridge, then you're in a whole new territory on the next film. You have such a place to start from, and the language is quicker and simpler, and you've had a lot more insight into their character and they into yours. And a lot of it is just, getting used to each other and understanding, how the other person thinks. So after, 20 years that Adam and I have been working together, it's kind of indescribable. I mean, I just today, literally 2 hours ago, I just came home from the studio the final day of mixing on Chloe, which is, Adam's latest film. It was a fantastic experience. And, I think my scores for his films are amongst the strongest things I've ever done. And I think it's simply because there's a sense of play and fun. We've got past the trauma and the heartache of, the early parts of the collaboration. Not that we ever even had that, but it's fun. I don't know any other way to describe it. And very often it's not fun. You're trying to unravel situations.
Yeah.
And, it's definitely my core collaboration.
Typically, when are you called upon to climb on board a project, and when would you ideally like to be called upon?
Well, that's another thing. When you work with someone repeatedly, you get to read drafts of scripts very early on. You're part of the project from its inception, and so the director is writing it with your voice in mind, and they want your feedback on the script. And so that's also another huge strength of getting in early and having that long-term relationship. That being said, I think the valuable part of seeing a script of a film that you're about to work on is to understand the director's relationship with the material. Musically, I don't think I've ever read a script and had a sound in mind that had anything to do with the final film, because the medium is completely different from typed words on a page. But what's important is to start the relationship between you, the film, and the director. So when is the ideal time? Well, that is the ultimate ideal time, but really the typical time is when the shooting is ended and they walk into the editing room. That's the best time, because that's when the temporary score is going to get put onto the film. And if you can have any say on that, that can be very, very helpful, because otherwise choices get made that will be very hard to unmake,
Well, in terms of composing those first notes, let's take Time Traveler's Wife, for example. Which is one of your latest scores. What do you have to understand before those first notes come to you about the film?
The questions that you ask the director are, why did you make the film? What do you like about the material? What is it that what are you saying? What is it that you feel the strengths and weaknesses are of where you are sitting here looking at your picture? If you can understand those things and starting out with those kind of big questions, those big philosophical questions, then you can start to put it together. I think you mustn't start writing anything until you have an idea of those, you know, and not only the director, it depends on the structure, the power structure of the film. Sometimes films are producer driven, sometimes they're studio driven, they're director driven, you know, picture editor driven, and the ultimate nightmare experience. But you know, whatever it is that you need to understand, you know, which voices are the ones to listen to. The films that I'm most attracted to are the ones where it's one person and it's the director.
I would imagine so.
Yeah, for obvious reasons, they're the most fun artistically, and but you know, I've worked on many films where that's not the case, and I think you can find a path in all of them to get to a great score and a great film. It can be more complicated, and you end up spending a lot more time on that part of the process than writing music sometimes, just understanding, coming to an understanding of what it is that people want out of the picture, you know, the different people want.
Is there a danger for a composer of being typecast?
Absolutely, and that's, you know, I recently turned down something for that exact reason, that I've done a couple of pictures in a row that are in a, you know, and they're very, very different, but they have a certain, they're in a kind of area of a genre. And
right.
I don't want to, you know, I've been very fortunate, by accident, I have to confess, in the early part of my career, but just kind of being all over the map as far as the kind of material and being able to do, you know, things from, you know, Little Miss Sunshine on one end of the spectrum to, you know, darker things like The Ice Storm. And being able to work in, you know, and then, you know, pictures that are based on relationships like Time Traveler's Wife or 500 Days of Summer and you know, all kinds of historical things and science fiction things. And that, I really, really treasured that part of my career. And it's something that, you know, honestly, it happened by accident with me. But I think a lot of composers do get. I mean, it's simple. You know, you do a picture that's like something else. You're watching that film, and you note the composer's name, and you call him, and then he ends up doing four in a row like that. And then that's, you know, he's stuck in that corner. And it's happened to a lot of people who, and if you talk to those composers, they're usually pretty unhappy about that.
I would imagine it would burn you out too. I mean, it would just creatively burn you out.
Absolutely. I mean, you can work on two films at once. You know, if they're opposite, it's quite, I won't say easy, but it's much simpler than if they're similar, then you have, you know, then you have problems. But you're able to keep them separate in your mind, and you just mine from a whole different part of your, you know, your internal world. Like you say, you don't kind of run that well dry by doing the same thing over and over again.
Well, let me ask you this, though. You talked about, you know, the different kind of like director-driven, producer-driven, studio-driven films. When you're done with your score, when you're done with initially, who has the final say? Who, like, is it the director or the producer, or is it like more, is it like a focus group almost, or what's been your experience?
Well, it can be, and the answer can be any of those things. And I think you have to, in order to be a successful film score composer, you have to be very sensitive to picking up, you know, what the answer to that question is that you just asked.
Right.
You know, smaller art films are much simpler. They're generally the director, and that's the end of the story.
Right.
But, you know, as the film gets bigger, you've got music departments, you've got heads of music, you've got, you know, all kinds of voices and you know, absolutely valid voices that you have to listen to and you have to take into account. I think you're best off if you listen to the director, that you talk to the director about any other opinions that come up, that, you know, that's a discussion. I mean, all the voices are welcome, all the opinions are welcome, but I do try and kind of narrow it down to, at the end of the day, it's me and the director mm-hmm. saying, okay, well, here's what, you know, we got this note, we have this person who thinks this, what, how do we address that? What do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think otherwise it can just get, it just can fly off into, you know, complete confusion.
Right.
So that the answer is, you know, for me, the director, always the director, you come back to that. But there, certainly you have to take into account the other voices.
Right.
Now, Jerry, you actually had a question about 500 Days, didn't you?
Yeah, I do have a question. When doing like a film like that where there's a lot of outside music that you're incorporating into the film, I was curious, what is, you know, obviously the Smiths are integral to the story because
right.
he's listening to them in that great scene in the elevator,
mm-hmm.
the beautiful scene. Who doesn't want to be serenaded by a Zooey Deschanel? But what I was curious about, do you have a say in what, like, the groups that you're going to use, like the bands or that?
Very rarely. It's very unusual that the composer is part of that discussion.
Okay.
In that particular film, you know, the Mark, the director, has, you know, a very close relationship with pop music, and
mm-hmm.
he, you know, I mean, that's his field, really. In
right.
Since he's a far, far greater expert in it than I am.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I love the songs he put together, and, you know, I thought they were brilliant, every mm-hmm. single one, and so they were all in place. I think virtually every single one was in place by the time, you know, I saw the film the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it, that really helps my job in that, you know, where you're presented with, you know, parts of the puzzle already in a sense that you work around, and you,
mm-hmm.
so your score has to be able to work within that universe that's already been, you know, that has already begun construction.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of 500 Days, yeah, that really helped us. You know, I think in a sense, we wanted to, you know, we already had kind of that, you know, that from the pop music we were getting certain elements, but we didn't want to repeat that. We wanted the music to do something maybe a little deeper and a little
right.
little different, but still be from a world that's not completely disassociated. So, you know, a 90-piece orchestra would not really make sense in the world
right.
where the Smiths live necessarily. I mean, it could, but, you know, it just seemed that something more intimate and a little more
delicate. Yeah.
Delicate, yeah, exactly.
Instrumental was beautiful. I thought it complemented the choices that he made. I mean, they were just really seamless almost.
Yeah, I mean, Mark, you know, and Mark, yeah, Mark was a fantastic collaborator to work with just for that reason that he knows pop music and he knows, you know, he's got a great musical knowledge and certainly, you know, that really kind of made it a very kind of educated collaboration
right.
in that way.
Right.
I want to ask you about one other collaboration before I let you go. And this is just an incredibly wildly imaginative filmmaker that you've worked with a couple of times now, and that's Terry Gilliam.
Right.
You've done the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, is that?
That's right, that's correct, yes.
Tell me about that experience.
Well, and again, yeah, working with Terry twice, and you have, you know, you start, especially on this film, because it was very, the schedule was pretty chaotic, and, you know, frankly, I think Terry thrives in that world of complete chaos and,
mm-hmm.
and with, you know, almost a medieval sense of complete, you know, just breakdown of you know, civilization, sort of the sense of working on a film with Terry. But that being said, it's an incredibly rich, creative environment, and Terry is the biggest, you know, cheerleader for the score that you could want. He's incredibly enthusiastic and generous and you know, just excited about the ideas as they're coming and guides it, but in a very, very positive way. He's got extraordinary energy and he has a sense of music, not in a way like Mark does, let's say, but he has a sense of the amount of energy and the kind of sonic impact that, you know, so he would, you know, in a very Python-esque way would, you know, hum or make noises as to what the score should be doing at a given point. He'd be okay, this would be, you know, and like, and so you would get this kind of aural, you know, finger painting in a sense, and you know, but honestly, it was extremely helpful, and we would remember that as we were working on it. You know, where he wanted the impact and what the general kind of density of it. And though you get a lot of information out of Terry's, you know, speech patterns in that way. So,
yeah,
it was, you know, again, just he's a fantastic collaborator and yeah, just a very positive kind of force, you know, yeah, I think the film turned out really beautifully, and I really hope people get to see it soon.
Okay, that is Michael Dana, composer. He has a few movies out now, a few movies coming out, including Time Traveler's Wife, 500 Days of Summer, and the upcoming Terry Gilliam-directed The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which I did read that it has worldwide distribution from Sony.
Well, when will it come out, though? Do we know? Do we have a release date?
I didn't read that, but
okay.
They're hoping that somebody like Sony Pictures Classics will release it here in the States.
Okay.
Yeah, but I would think fall, with the level of, well, yeah, which is very
well,
soon.
I mean, I say this, and I don't say this in a cynical way, and a lot of people over the last couple of days have thought I meant it cynically, but it would be the highest grossing film of Mr. Gilliam's career.
It very well could potentially be.
And I don't mean that in a negative way to discount his earlier works. I just mean that given the...
Right now, that's probably The Fisher King.
Yeah.
You think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That or The 12 Monkeys, one of those two.
Right,
but.
Right. So we appreciate Mr. Dana's time. It was a great conversation. We
always
talking film scores. Chris, how you doing, man?
Doing great. How are you guys?
We're doing good.
Good.
Then we're starting off on the right foot, then.
Once, we are starting off on the right foot.
So, how
do we want to start this off? What do we want to talk about on this? What is the most pressing issue of the day?
The most pressing issue of the day. Well, in terms of movie news,
yeah,
I don't know.
No, I was thinking healthcare debate. Let's have it
no,
right here.
No. I don't need to hear. Oh my God, my country is disappearing from me. I don't need to hear that shit. Okay,
well, I just meant sometimes we do movie news, sometimes we do debates about movie themes and things.
We're
going to
do all of it.
We're
going to
do
all
of it. We're going to cover all of it, but I
news.
Promise you this, we're not going to come off as ignorant white trash.
No, we're not.
Okay?
We're just going to come.
I say that proudly on my show. We're not going to come off like that because my country has not been taken away from me.
Right.
Wow. Well, I opened up a can of worms.
You did,
let's talk
Andy,
about,
you did, but it's your nature, okay?
Let's talk about the movies then. Chris, have you seen anything lately?
Movies it is. Yeah, we went and saw...
Healthcare Geeks United.
Yeah. Hey, you brought it up, baby, not me.
Wicker Furniture Enthusiasts United.
Yeah.
You went to see what?
Let's see. Went and saw Funny People last week. Went and saw District 9 last night.
All right. Well, let's talk about District 9 then. I'm the only one that hasn't seen it because I'm a loser. But Jerry and Chris have seen it. Talk amongst yourselves.
Okay.
I have
no complaints.
I have no complaints either. I enjoyed it very much. I thought the documentary style worked well, although they do sort of abandon that style for the most part in the middle of the movie. You don't really mind so much. You kind of understand that it needed to be abandoned, and you sort of follow his character for a little bit, and then you get back to the documentary style. I thought it was really fun. I mean, I thought it had a lot of this sort of social significance, but it doesn't really, it's not like right on the nose, you know. It doesn't
bash your head over with it, you know.
No, not in any way. At the same time, you're still sort of thinking about those themes and ideas throughout the entire movie. And it had some, you know, interesting use of special effects and as well as some, one interesting actor, really. The lead actor is quite good, although...
It's amazing that the film does rest on that portrayal. Because if that
yeah,
doesn't work,
does.
If we don't buy that, we don't buy the film.
No, he's quite good, and
yeah.
Actually, you hate him and you love him all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But he pulls it off, and he's very, very convincing, and you actually feel for him quite a bit when he's going. And I'll say that you feel for the aliens too. There's a sort of a main alien character whose name is Christopher, and he is really, although you can't see his face, the eyes are the only humanoid type quality he has, other than, you know, he's a biped, he walks on two legs, and he has eyes. Other than that, they're completely hideous and very unpleasant to look at.
Right.
But you really do get into this character and his young son, and you really feel for him. It's pretty amazing. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And then the whole thing wraps up for the last 30 minutes with just sort of a balls-out action movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
The entire theater I was in seemed to really be enjoying it, with the exception of a couple of the people that I went and saw it with. I haven't talked to anybody who disliked the movie. So I would recommend everyone go see it. It's got something for everyone. It's got something for people who want the dumb stuff and something for people who want a little bit of substance too. So.
Yeah, I mean, Chris is absolutely right. It does. I'm curious of the people. I mean, I would imagine there are going to be people who don't like this film, but it is amazing how, for what it is, it's perfect. There's just little things like the last shots of the film reminded me of The Outer Limits. I want to say William Shatner or Robert Culp. Like, these are not the recent Outer Limits from the 90s, but from the 60s. It was, like, a famous story with William Shatner, and it's just when that character, the main character, in the alien form, it's
mm-hmm.
just beautiful. There's something poetic
yeah.
about that last, like, 2 or 3 minutes.
I have a question
completed.
To ask about it in just a second. Let me take a phone call. We have a 310 area code on the line.
Oh,
310?
Hi, yeah.
Hi, welcome to Movie Geeks United. How are you?
Good, thanks. I saw District 9 last night and just heard you guys talking about it. I didn't actually, it started off and I thought, you know, the interviews straight to camera, and I kind of thought this isn't what I was expecting, and I didn't really feel that worked, but then the movie just completely changed gear and when it started to tell the story.
Right.
That's a question I was actually going to ask. So it starts out kind of like a you are there kind of Blair Witch kind of thing, and then it turns into a regular narrative form, or
it does start out like it's almost like an episode of The Office. The characters speak directly to the camera, and actually, it really is mockumentary almost because they're sort of cracking jokes.
That's what
and stuff.
I meant. Yeah.
A lot of jokes, actually.
Yeah, it's a very funny movie. And then that sort of, at a certain point, I'd say about 30 or 40 minutes into the movie, that sort of subsides a little bit. They occasionally will cut back to, you know, maybe a quick talking head or something like that. But for the most part, you sort of follow this one character around, and it takes a more standard narrative form. And then it sort of jumps back into
it
the,
does
the
go back to
style.
That towards the end.
So
but it's
so
not... It's not jarring ever. The only time it's jarring, I guess, is when you first sit down in the movie. Because if you're not expecting that, like the caller was just talking about, then yeah, I would imagine that would be a little jarring. But it's,
yeah,
in terms of sitting and watching the movie, it's not bothersome.
So caller, what's your name?
Roland.
Roland. So did you end up enjoying it? Is it something you'd recommend?
I'd been to the movies 3 nights back to back. I'd seen 500 Days of Summer, I've seen G.I. Joe, and I saw District 9, and I actually thought it was the freshest, most original movie I've seen in a long time, and I think probably as far as an alien film, it was completely kind of rejigged the genre, really.
I see that. I mean, it's a thinking person's Alien Nation, that's for sure.
Does it make you regret seeing this director's work that we're not going to see his version of Halo that he was going to do with Peter Jackson?
No, because this is
I think it's a bloody blessing.
Yeah, you know, like if he made a Halo movie, he'd probably make a pretty good one. But
yeah, but he would. But
probably...
he contradicts.
Go ahead.
Halo contradicts Peter Jackson's introduction of this film at Comic-Con, where he's rallying against the comic book adaptations, the remakes and everything, you know, because let's be honest,
these guys met, oh, we're going to make Halo into a movie. And I know, you know, it's a very popular game for Xbox, but does anyone, let's be very honest here, does anyone really want to see a movie adaptation of Halo? I know we're all going to be there opening day, but that Saturday, does anyone really give a shit?
Isn't Ridley Scott doing it now?
I think Ridley Scott, isn't he doing Monopoly or the Alien prequel?
He's doing both.
Oh, right.
I don't know about a Halo movie, but remember, Jamie, you and I used to sit and play Halo for hours. Remember?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Let me ask you guys this. Let me say this. But as a game, that's great. That's fun. It's exciting. But did you ever
exactly.
say to yourselves, oh, I want to really see a movie of this?
No. What made it such a great game was what makes everything a great game. It the way that it's interactive is
yeah.
fantastic. That's great. But the story of Halo is nothing that really needs to be told. I mean, I don't really even know if I could describe to you what the story is. It's basically a humans versus aliens kind of thing. There's not much there. So, no,
yeah,
I don't think it's a tragedy that Neil Blomkamp, or whatever his name is not going to be making the Halo movie. Whatever
yeah, I think
he does
this is
make,
a happy accident or whatever. That
even so, I mean, it would be a Peter Jackson production, and I don't think he would willingly back something that wouldn't be exciting to people.
No, I don't think he would. I just don't think it's a tragedy that we're not going to get that. Whatever
yeah,
he
Halo
does.
Movie, I'm not losing sleep over that.
No, yeah. I think Jerry's right when he said it was a happy blessing. I mean, it's still a Peter Jackson-produced movie, and it's still Neil Blomkamp, and he made, you know, you could probably argue that, like Jerry said, it was a blessing in disguise. They went and took something and made something original rather than, you know, sort of rehashing something that certainly would have been entertaining but might not have had the social significance
yes.
that District 9
do you think,
does.
Do you think thank you for calling Roland, by the way, Beverly Hills caller. Awesome. Do you think that the message is lost on people?
No.
I think it could be. I think it definitely could be on some people.
Some people, but on a majority, I don't think so. I think people get it, and the only reason I say that is because he doesn't shove it in your face.
Yeah.
If he shoved it in your face, then I might, but that's beside the point. You take where this gentleman grew up, his life story and everything, but he doesn't shove it in your face.
No, it's definitely not on the nose the way that it could be in the hands of a lesser director. And that's the other thing I will say about the movie. It is one of those times when you're sort of watching a movie, and whether you're involved in the story or not, you do sort of, if you're a fan of filmmaking, you do sort of stop for a second and say, wow, this is a young director, and this is quite a job he's done here. I mean, he's really going to be somebody that you're going to hear about more and more in the years to come.
Yeah.
I did have to take note at one point during the theater, during the showing last night, and think, wow, this is a debut film? Like, it's kind of hard to believe.
Yeah. I agree with you, Chris, there, yeah.
Now, Chris, so you saw Funny People too. Now, let's talk, just tying this in with the box office. District 9 opened in first place. It had a really nice debut, I think something like $36.8 million.
Mm-hmm.
G.I. Joe's doing well. God help us all. And then
it's not doing that well. G.I. Joe is actually considered a disaster.
Well, it's in second place with $22 million on a second weekend,
not,
almost $100 million grosser.
Yeah, but
and
G.I.
for
Joe
a second,
G.I. Joe doesn't have Megan Fox. Actually, G.I. Joe is considered a failure by a lot of people because it doesn't have that Transformers 2. God, I never thought I'd say this. These Transformers 2 legs because it dropped a lot.
Well, neither does. I mean, District 9 doesn't have Megan Fox, but that's considered a success.
Yeah, but I mean,
I don't think I think it is a success.
Could be in Johannesburg.
3 weeks ago, we were talking about how the studio fired the director and they had to re-edit it, and people were saying they weren't screening it. People were saying this is such a god awful movie, and it's made $100 million in 2 weeks. That's a success.
And
for
most people who I talk to who have seen it, I have not, but most people I talk to have seen it. Don't seem to dislike it so much. In fact, they most people I've talked to said, it's pretty good, you know.
Can I say something, Chris, about that? Can I give my
yeah.
2 cents? Because I am a co-host on the show. I've seen it. Sienna Miller was not in the film. I would have walked out.
Well, that's
okay.
Because you have taste.
All right. That's what I want to say.
The people that made Transformers 2 the top movie of the year are the same people going to this, by and large.
Well, that's true, but I mean...
That's true, but those people seem to really... Even people that went to see Transformers 2 will sort of admit that it was pretty bad. And people aren't necessarily willing to say that about G.I. Joe.
Because it's a lesser of two evils.
I guess so. Maybe it's a little bit less...
But I have to say something about G.I. Joe.
Overtly bad.
I have to say something about G.I. Joe, and I told Jamie this, I think, before we interviewed our composer friend earlier. You know, for $175 million, I would like to think that we could have found a special effects company that could have made our special effects look not so bad. Because,
yeah.
Chris, you're watching this film, and there are a couple of sequences, you're just like, I've seen better 80s television that look more realistic than this.
Well, that's Stephen Summers for you.
I did sneak in and watch about 20 minutes of it last week.
It's pretty bad.
I wasn't like disgusted by what I saw, but I also wasn't. I didn't bother to have a seat either. I just sort of stood there and watched it, and it didn't have one effect or the other on me.
You went and had a drink afterwards.
No, I was waiting for another movie to start, and I got there quite early. I just walked in, as I am off to do, and just sort of walked into a couple other movies to check out a couple minutes of them. It seemed harmless and boring, in my opinion. Like that, I watched 20 minutes of it, and it was literally about 20 minutes of action. There was just no real story or anything like that. I don't want to sound like I'm reviewing the movie. I'm not. I did not see it. I'm just saying the 20 minute chunk that I saw, not my cup of tea.
No, it's not. And what I couldn't get over though was it does feel like when you're watching it, you feel like you're watching the outtakes reel of the X-Men films and the Star Wars prequels.
Yeah.
That's not good. But what I was amazed about when I went home and I saw how much it cost, is like, you mean for this kind of money, you couldn't get better effects work? Because
That's sort of a theme this year, is movies that have huge budgets like that and Wolverine, which don't look like it, and then movies which have smaller budgets like District 9 cost $30 million, and you wouldn't know it. I mean, it looks really, really good.
You would never know it with District 9. The special effects are seamless. I mean,
yeah, for $30 million, they got a hell of a lot of movie out of it.
Oh,
now,
they did.
I'm sure Peter Jackson producing and him having whatever he has to do with Weta, you know, the production... The special effects company. I'm sure that maybe saved a few ducats here and there, but
we got a call on an 862 area code. This marks the most time we will ever dedicate to G.I. Joe.
Yeah, I'm kind of shocked.
For the remainder of the show's future, 862 area code. You're on the air. All right, great.
862, are you there?
So, Chris, you saw G.I. Joe. You saw Funny People.
I did. Yeah.
And
yeah,
we've talked about Funny People in the previous weeks, but I want to know if your opinion is similar on it.
Funny People, I like Judd Apatow's both his last movies. I love 4-Year-Old Virgin. I love Knocked Up. There seemed to be a lot of sort of revisionist history with Knocked Up. All of a sudden, everybody wanted to talk about how it wasn't good. Like when it came out in the theaters, everybody seemed to love it. And all of a sudden it came out.
I want to talk about that too. Yeah.
You know what I'm? Have you recognized that too? All of
a
sudden on DVD,
I know people like went in like, oh, I don't like this movie, but they loved it when it was in the theater, but they don't like it.
I don't understand that, because I think Knocked Up holds up very, very well. I think it's just as funny as 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a big Judd Apatow fan. Especially considering those are his first two and only movies. And then, so I was real excited and real, I'm also a big fan of stand-up comedy. I follow many stand-up comedians. I've read several biographies of stand-up comedians. So this was right in my wheelhouse.
Right.
And I enjoyed the first hour of the movie. Thought it worked pretty well. I wasn't nuts about it, but I thought it was going somewhere good. Although, of course, I'd heard, like everyone, that it takes a big turn, sort of stylistically and sort of thematically, and that's where it kind of lost me. In fact, it even lost me before they got to San Francisco or wherever it was.
Or Marin County, really, yeah.
Yeah, Marin County. Like, it really was sort of coming off the wheels before they took that little trip there anyway.
I'm just curious, Chris, where did you lose interest before Marin County?
It wasn't any one part. The thing is, the movie doesn't have a plot. And this is kind of flying under the radar, but it's happening a lot more than it used to. Like, you know, if you had put that idea of a movie on paper for a studio executive in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, even the 90s, like, that would not fly. Like, that movie would never get made because it has no plot. Somehow, this decade, it's happening a lot, I've noticed. There's movies that just sort of exist with no plot whatsoever, and they call them character studies, but that doesn't always work, especially doesn't work when you don't have, A, very many good characters, and B, the characters you do have are extremely unlikable, which I found to be the case.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%.
I mean, obviously, the George Simmons character is supposed to be unlikable. That's kind of his role. But I didn't find the Seth Rogen character to be a very likable guy either. Maybe
no,
that's
because
sort of
no. I need to ask you though. What was it? What was the first thing? What made you not like the Seth Rogen character?
It really wasn't anything in particular. Like, he just was sort of spineless, and also another, you know, I'm not the first person to notice this, but not very funny, and that's just part of the movie.
Right. No, he's not funny. And
that always happens. Well, the George Simmons character's not funny either. I never understand that in movies where someone's supposed to be funny, or they're supposed to be writing jokes, or a TV show's supposed to be a big hit, and you watch 5 minutes of it on the movie, and it just doesn't look very good.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look like something you'd watch. He doesn't seem like a comedian I would watch, nor does George Simmons seem like a comedian I would watch. But then again, I don't like Adam Sandler. So, no, it was just a meandering movie, I thought. That was basically my problem with it.
Meandering is the perfect word for it.
Yeah, it was just all over the place, just in and out, here and there, never really got anywhere. I my favorite performance and the only bit of life in the movie, I thought, was Eric Bana. I didn't, what's her name, the girl, I can't see anything in her performance or in that character that was particularly interesting either.
Shockingly bland in it for once.
Yeah, I thought Eric Bana had the only real live performance in the movie. And
he was
not
happy to be there, I think. He was just so happy to be there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he was also a stand-up comedian, a lot of people don't know about him, but he was...
Yeah, but the Chopper, I mean, and Chopper is...
Yeah, he's hysterical on that.
Yeah.
I think that we all agree on funny people, and the vast majority of people that have seen it have the same opinion. It
mm-hmm.
seems to be a universal pan of that second, over the second half, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to paint the movie as entirely unfunny. There were definitely a couple moments where I laughed. But those were few and far between, and that in-between area was a
mm-hmm.
lot of meandering nonsense that I
right.
didn't care about. Didn't
well,
care
showing,
about.
In the showing in the box office, it's exited the top 10. It's going to be his lowest grossing film
today. Oh, it exited the top 10 this weekend?
Yeah.
Bandslam did better than that?
After 3 weeks. It's going to be his lowest grosser.
Yeah.
And for a star vehicle, which he hasn't directed before, to be his lowest grosser, I mean, that's probably a disappointment.
Wow.
But I'm sure he's going to be fine. But
he has nothing to worry about.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about Avatar.
Tomorrow. It's kind of hard to believe that we still haven't seen any real Avatar explosion yet.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to see the first sort of little waves of it here, but we still haven't seen this movie that we seem like we've been talking about ever since we've had this show. And
right.
We have been talking about it ever since we've had this show.
That's
true. And we still haven't even really seen much footage of it. Some people have, but not us.
The trailer will be out Friday. Tomorrow on the website, avatarmovie.com, I think, I don't know the exact time, I think it's 12 p.m. Eastern. Or 12 p.m. Pacific. I'm not sure which one. I'll find out. You can go online. There are 100 IMAX 3D screens in the world that they're playing 16 minutes of new footage on Friday, August 21st at 6 o'clock and 6:30. Now, when you go on their website Monday, you can snatch those tickets up, pick the theater that's closest to you, and get a ticket for you and a friend. And they're going to go really, really fast. It's like an internet lottery almost. But that's going to be the Avatar Day, 16 minutes of footage screened on Friday. Monday you can get the tickets. It's a genius marketing move, I think. It's not on as many screens as I'd like it to be, but it has to be a hassle, first of all, because it affects the scheduling of whatever their previous show is at all these theaters and their show afterwards.
See, Quentin Tarantino did something to James Cameron I don't know about.
Yeah, well, and plus, I mean, Chris, you and I, coming from the theater exhibition industry like we did many years ago, you've got no turnaround between these two showings.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably going to have long, long lines,
yeah.
You know, and then the scheduling, like I just mentioned. So it could be tricky how they pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think that this is a smart move, Chris?
Yeah, I see how it's a smart move. I see how for James Cameron and for the makers of Avatar, this is a smart move. Gets a lot of people out there. Maybe most of the people that are in the theater are going to see the movie regardless, ironically.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the people that get these tickets, that log on whenever this becomes available, 10 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is, and get
mm-hmm.
these tickets, will have, this will convince maybe, I don't know, 2% of the people that go see it to go see it, you know. Most of them were already going to go see it anyway.
Right.
So, you know, but it still is a, sort of a marketing blitz move. It still gets more people to know about the movie, I guess, a little bit. I personally wouldn't want to go do this, not only because we don't have an IMAX theater here, so that means I would have to travel to go see it, but I don't want to see 16 minutes of a movie that I have to wait a couple more months to see.
That's where I'm at, Chris. I'm with you there.
I just don't. I'm not interested. Like, I want to see the preview for the movie. Absolutely. I'm chomping at the bit to see the preview for the movie because, like I said, we've been talking about it for 2 years. But I don't want to see 16 minutes of footage because that's 16 minutes that's going to be completely uninteresting and undynamic
mm-hmm.
when I do finally see it in December. So, yeah, this is not for me, but it's I think it's a good idea just because it's charging up the Avatar train, as it were, you know.
Right.
And that's a testament to the buzz the movie already has, and to the filmmaker that he is, that he's able to do this. I mean, imagine someone else doing this. It's not. I can't think of another thing that this would work for, you know, like another event type movie. Even the big things like Harry Potter, or if they made another Indiana Jones movie and said, oh, come see 16 minutes of new Indiana Jones, I don't think people would go do that. This is a new type of filmmaking, a new
mm-hmm.
type of 3D filmmaking that maybe this will end up being a better idea than I'm giving it credit for. Maybe this will really get people sort of foaming at the mouth and excited about it the way they weren't before.
Yeah. It's possible. I'm probably not. I'm going to try. I'm going to try to log in and see what I can do. But I suck at those lottery things, man.
Mm-hmm.
I never get in.
Yeah. But don't you guys want to see Inglourious Basterds Friday, or am I the only one that really wants to see this Friday?
We're going to see it. We're going to see it this weekend. I mean, you know, it's either. It's only like 16 minutes of Avatar footage, so it's not like it's going to take your whole day away from
you. No, I realize that, but it is a very movie marketing, you know, it's a big deal.
Yeah. And meanwhile, reviews have started to pour in for Inglourious Basterds, and there seems to be a theme here that I'm reading in some of these reviews.
Well, enlighten us.
It seems that people either are crazy about the movie or lukewarm about the movie. And
like
those that are
Entertainment Weekly review?
Those that are lukewarm don't get Tarantino anymore, or he's not as fresh for them as he used to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he was such a fresh filmmaker and he did such surprising things that people expect that time after time to be shown something, you know.
Right.
That they haven't necessarily, like, almost they want to rediscover a new voice each time he does a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost makes them immune to what is now a Tarantino movie.
Right.
It's kind of the sentiment that I'm reading by the people.
No,
I
understand what you're saying, because the most recent review I read was Entertainment Weekly. And
right.
That definitely fits what you're saying.
Glenn Kenny loved it. I mean, Glenn Kenny said what I say about Tarantino movies. That, you know, this is about
movie
love.
Oh, yeah, he did.
It gets you excited about movies. Yeah. But we're all still excited about it, Chris, right?
Yes, I am still excited about it. Although I have noticed that, like, if you look at the first three Tarantino movies, Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, and then you look at the Kill Bill movies, Grindhouse, and I'm assuming this movie, just based on the clips and trailers that I have seen from it, the dialogue, which has always been the best thing about Tarantino, no matter what anybody says, he's actually not an amazing director. He's quite good, but that's not where his, that's not what got our attention, you know? There's not much in terms of flashiness in the filmmaking of Reservoir Dogs or in Pulp Fiction, for that matter. What was so interesting was the character studies and the way they were pieced together, like this awesome puzzle that you'd never really seen anything like that before or heard anything like that before.
Right.
It was a little bit more believable, though, as I'm thinking about it more recently in those three movies, that those characters would speak like that, whereas The Bride and the Kill Bill movies and the characters in the Grindhouse movie, and it seems the characters in this new movie, almost sort of winking at the camera with their dialogue and with the way that they speak, and they're almost a little bit too cool for the room, whereas you would believe that those seven jewel thieves sort of talked like that and had these long-winded conversations in the back of a car about a TV or a radio station that they've been listening to in the last couple months.
Okay, I'd like to ask you, what is it about the two Kill Bill movies that you don't think is Tarantino-esque?
It's not that I don't think it's Tarantino-esque. I just feel like he's sort of playing a different instrument in terms of the dialogue. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I'll be very honest with you. Of the movies released this decade, the two Kill Bill movies are the only movies I go back and watch repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
I know it. There's a certain level of catharsis in those movies, but there's also a lot of humor in those movies. I mean, especially in the second one, Joey Bishop's son, Larry Bishop, his scene in the strip club is hysterical.
Yeah, he's very funny.
I mean, I know for a lot of people that's the highlight of the movie, but I understand what the dialogue quoting isn't in those films, especially not in Death Proof, that it is in the first three films, or in True Romance, for that matter.
Yeah, or in True Romance or Natural Born Killers.
The Kill Bill films are magical.
No, I do too. And I'm not. And actually, that's an interesting word because it's very accurate. That's what is so different from the first couple movies. Like, you believe that a Mr. White character actually existed, that there was an undercover cop named Mr. Orange or whatever his name actually was. That seemed very realistic. Vincent Vega seemed very realistic. Lance, his drug dealer, Eric Stoltz with the robe and the beard.
Yeah.
Beard. Seemed like a real guy somewhere out there in Malibu that had a place like that and sat and ate cereal in bed late at night and ignored the phone while his wife screamed, you know? Like, that seems so realistic. The Bride in the Kill Bill movies does not seem like a realistic movie. It's magical. It's sort of magical filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And he's quite good at that. And actually, he does do in those movies, in these more recent movies, what I'm arguing that he didn't necessarily do in the first couple movies, which is that sort of flashy filmmaking. And he's good at it. But having said that, he sort of took his foot off of the realistic dialogue.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Now, these are all real mealy-mouth complaints, because I like all his... At the end of the day, I like all of his movies. I'm just saying, I do sort of hope that, whether it's Inglourious Basterds or some other movie, he gets back to making movies about real characters in a real world, dealing with real issues, rather than just sort of magical... sort of daydreamy type, let's all go club some Nazis kind of thing. Like, you know, like...
Right, no, I understand what you're saying. I understand.
But I'm very excited about this movie, and we've been hearing about this movie for as long as we've been hearing about Avatar, in fact, longer.
We've been hearing about this since, I think, Jackie Brown, to be honest.
Yeah. So, no, I'm very excited about it, and, you know, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I'm sure I'll fall in that love it category.
Yeah.
And if we love it, one thing's for certain, a certain critic by the name of Armand White will hate it. Armand White, I just bring that up.
District 9.
Yes, and in reference to District 9, his review of District 9, he got hundreds upon hundreds and hundreds of comments from angry readers. They do every week. But these were particularly vicious, some of which I'm sure many of which hadn't even seen the movie yet. They just opposed Armand White's pan of something that is pretty universally praised,
right,
which is par for the course for Armand White. Now, one thing that fascinates me about this is how people continue to go back to the things that incense them. Armand White's opinions just enrage them, and yet they continue to go back and read his reviews. That's interesting to me, because maybe it gives them a sense that they matter when they can put their anger to words in reference to one of his reviews. I don't know what it is. I don't know what the psychology of that is. The second thing is it's quite amusing. Ebert wrote a big blog defending Armand White. And then, I guess...
He's really going all out in his last phase. He's really...
Yeah, but then he investigated a little further, and then he came out with another blog and detracted his defense. He says, "I am forced to conclude that White is, as charged, a troll." I just thought that was very funny.
Yeah, it is. That's hysterical. I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, that's the kind of honesty that makes me love Roger Ebert so much.
Yeah.
It makes me continue to call him our greatest living critic.
Mm-hmm.
He really is, and the most prolific, the most worthwhile, and the most in love with movies.
He has to be prolific now. He doesn't speak anymore, so.
Yeah, I mean, he writes better than... there's also the movie show. They got rid of their two critics, Michael Phillips and Ben Lyons, their two entertainment reporters.
They got Ben Lyons and Ben Mankiewicz, I thought, were the two Bens.
Ben Mankiewicz, right. Why'd I say
that? I was just getting used to them, too.
Really?
Yeah, you know, Ben Mankiewicz actually is not that bad. In fact,
he's actually a pretty good
reviewer, I think, and has really good taste in movies. And Ben Lyons is... That show has always sort of been about that, and it's interesting. I was making this argument the other day with someone. That show has always, you know, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, they both had fairly common tastes in movies when that show first started. It wasn't like one of them was a movie snob and the other one wasn't.
That's true, Chris.
Sort of built into that. But as that show has always gone, whether it was Siskel and Ebert, or Ebert and Roper, or Roper and some guest, or Ben and Ben, someone usually takes the high road and someone usually takes the low road in terms of movie taste. It just sort of works out that way, which is interesting because they have chosen Michael Phillips and A.O. Scott, who are both very sort of movie snobs. There's no other real way to say it.
When you put A.O. Scott in your show, you're really going... for broke in that movie snob category.
They both have very highbrow sort of film palettes.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to be hearing a lot of positive reviews for Transformers 2 or 3 or whatever fucking Transformer movie comes out next.
You're not going to hear anything for that.
I made that argument at first, but I do feel like the nature of that show is someone will sort of feel the need to defend that lowbrow common film Transformers,
the stuff that you remember the most from those shows are the disagreements, you know, the passionate disagreements.
I think that comes more from anything, more than someone truly defending a movie. It comes from the need to sort of defend a movie that you know that the masses sort of like. I don't think that they always truly are defending it honestly.
Yeah, I think it would be great if they have kind of opposing philosophies about certain things about movies. That makes the show interesting and just not one talking ahead. But I never saw their version of At the Movies. But my understanding of it, Chris, is that it was built differently. It was structured more of an entertainment type show.
People made that argument, and I don't really understand that. At the end of the day, it was two guys sitting around and talking about movies, and instead
Which
of thumbs
guys,
and thumbs down, they gave see it, skip it, or rent it. I mean,
right.
it did look a little bit more with the, you know, like the flashy colors and stuff like that. They weren't in the balcony like they were on Siskel and Ebert. It was just on a TV set with a big screen behind them where they would watch the clips and stuff. But the show was the same. Those two guys just didn't quite work as well, I guess.
This incarnation goes back to the Ebert and Siskel and Ebert
formula. I go back to Siskel and Ebert. I'll be very honest with you. I go back to Siskel and Ebert in the early 80s when they were on public television. And I watched them a little bit when they were on, like, syndicated, but I didn't watch them religiously. I watched them religiously on PBS, but that was it.
I remember the guys, the other guys, there was a couple of public television shows. There was one with...
Jeffrey Lyons and Michael Medved or
right.
Neil Gabler, and that was the thing that replaced them when they went to syndication. And, God, let's not talk about Michael Medved. I don't want to give that guy any legitimacy. But
yeah, the thing that I was talking about, though, is there was a show called Sneak Previews.
Yeah, that was the one.
And it might have been Michael Medved. And the other was this guy with red hair and a bushy mustache. Who was that?
Oh, my God. That wasn't Michael Medved.
That guy, yeah, but he
it
was partnered.
It could have been him, or it could have been Neil Gabler, for that matter. I mean,
he was paired with Michael Medved, and I can't remember who the guy was.
That could have been Neil Gabler, who wrote the very good book, An Empire of Their Own. Oh, my God. Let's stop talking about this.
That's this trivia question of the week. If anyone can give me that answer, you win a free toaster oven.
You have a toaster oven?
It's somewhere. It's
okay.
In storage. Something else that's worth talking about, maybe. I was looking back. We have all these retrospectives in the news now about 1969, 40 years ago, and all the tremendous events that occurred in that year, some horrific, some triumphant. And I was thinking about how the movies have handled that. That was a major year. We're heavily embroiled in Vietnam, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And coming out of that was something like the moon landing, I think, happened in July.
Right.
The Tate-LaBianca murders for Manson happened August 9th. The week after that, Woodstock occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it might be a little bit worthwhile to discuss some of the movies that have emanated from those times and what impresses us about them. The moon landing, obviously. Do you think the right stuff in the non-documentary form is the movie that stands tallest there?
It is, but it stops short of that, though.
Yeah,
it doesn't,
that's the
it's a great film, but it doesn't. I would say that documentary that came out in 2007, It's in the Shadow of the Moon, is a more accurate portrayal of that time, because the right stuff doesn't go up to that. But
The Right Stuff, though, I would argue The Right Stuff is the greatest movie about the space program in general.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, no argument there. The perfect film about the space program.
Yeah, doesn't get into Apollo, but, it obviously stops just shy of Apollo.
Well, it's not about Greek mythology. It's about the moon.
Thank God. He's here every night, folks.
I would definitely agree with that. I mean, Right Stuff is the kind of movie, if only every subject could have that type of epic filmmaking.
The movie only has one flaw, and it's nothing to do with the actual making of the movie. The movie was, sadly, when it came out, was used as the John Glenn presidential platform.
Yeah,
and that's
not the movie's fault, though.
No, it's not the movie's fault, but that's the way the movie was advertised. That's why the...
Well, you might, yeah. I mean, that's the same thing as saying that Bruce Springsteen has one flaw and that Born in the USA was used for Reaganism.
No, this was a big deal, Jamie, at the time, in 1984. The film was used as the John Glenn's presidential campaign. That's not a myth. That's not bullshit coming from me. That's how it was used, and that's why the film never did as well as it should have.
So the studio took the movie and backed the campaign with the movie?
Basically. I'm not bullshitting you here. I'm not just saying this to say it, but the film never caught on at the time it came out.
Right. I don't know about that. I don't know how well it caught on.
People appreciated it, but it was really a movie that more or less, when it came out on VHS and afterwards on cable, it really struck a chord with people. But sadly, it was used as the... the film was hijacked as, this is going to be John Glenn's presidential campaign. And that's how it was at the time. I hate to say that, but that's how it was. But I think it's one of the greatest films ever made.
Good old Philip Kaufman. I want to talk about Manson and Woodstock, too.
Mm.
We got a caller. It's an unidentified number.
Maybe
I just see straight ones. caller, somebody that just connected with us. You're on the air if you want to say something.
Yeah, once again.
Let me try the 862 again. 862 area code, did you want to contribute? Okay. Maybe you guys are calling in because you can't hear the show live on the page. I understand.
Yeah, I mean, we appreciate that.
But if you're in the chat room and you happen to be one of these two lines and you do have something to say, then let us know and I'll pick up your line again. Okay, so the moon, and obviously there have been great documentaries in The Shadow of the Moon. It was just about under 2 years ago, and it was very well highly acclaimed. But it's also relevant, too, looking at the space program now and the attention to going back to the moon, which, you know, I don't know about that. But
yeah, I read, I think it was yesterday or today in one of the papers, like 20 years. It would take like 20 years
right.
before we go back to the moon. So that's a sad thing. When I read those, it makes me sad.
But there have been a lot of, on the periphery, a lot of excellent movies about the space program, but more specifically the dreams that it instilled in the youth.
Yeah.
In the 60s, early 70s, something like October Sky.
I was just thinking that's a great film, good example.
Yeah, it's a very good film. And it was fascinating because that was a very hopeful event of that year.
Yeah.
And then you had the Manson family, which they said spelled the end of hippie love, you know, in some metaphors they said that. But it was really a shock to the system.
Mm-hmm.
When that occurred. And there have been a couple of films about that tragedy and those murders and endless fascination with Charles Manson as a
yeah.
cult figure, the ultimate face of evil, and then the family itself. It's
really been a movie that totally captured it quite well, though. I mean, they made the Helter Skelter movie, and then they made the Jeremy Davies version of that. They'd never really made, and it's such an interesting story, and it has
yeah.
captured so many people's fascination, and it's just...
Mm-hmm.
Not just one story to be told there. There's quite a few stories that could be made into certainly very interesting movies, and it's never really been done. I don't know why.
Well, let me ask you this. In 1994, there were the two autobiographies that came out that talked about this. Robert Evans, The Kid Stays in the Picture, talks about this, but also Marlon Brando's autobiography, he mentions this too.
Right.
You know, everyone who lived during that time mentions this, and sometimes very great detail, like those two books I brought up.
Yeah.
What do you think is missing cinematically?
From the story that it hasn't been touched?
Yeah.
I don't know. You bring up an interesting point, which is maybe people just don't want to touch it out there. You know?
Right.
Although, you know, they've touched their own disasters before. There's certainly been movies that have been made out of true Hollywood stories.
Sure.
But,
yeah.
Zodiac, Summer of Sam, on and on, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, Jerry. I really do think that there's quite an interesting. I mean, it's really a fucking fascinating story. Like, there's a reason.
It's a very frightening story. If you really, you know, I read in Rick Perlstein's book Nixon Lamb, which is about Richard Nixon in the 60s and just the whole period, the whole political period. And he recounts a story, and, you know, whenever you read it, I don't care how many times you've read that thing about Sharon Tate, it's a scary
yeah.
telling. It's frightening.
It fascinated and terrified me as a teenager.
Yeah.
I was really taken by it. But here's the question, and then I'll let you finish your thought, Chris. A great movie adaptation of this story, would you take the direction of a horror film, like I think that a couple of years ago, The Manson Family, that really controversial film took.
Yeah.
Would you take it more as a true crime novelization kind of approach like a Zodiac?
Absolutely the latter every day of the week. I would never want to see a horrorized version of this movie, of this story. I mean, I would just absolutely never want to see that.
Right.
In fact, what I was going to ask was something kind of similar, which is, script aside, who would be, in my opinion, I know who my answer would be, but who would be the best filmmaker to tackle that story?
Before we talk about that, there was a rumor out just last week that Oliver Stone was remaking Helter Skelter.
That is my answer. I didn't hear that rumor. Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you.
I absolutely think he would be the perfect filmmaker, and I think it's the exact kind of movie that could be a real return to form for him.
Co-script by Vincent Bugliosi,
wow.
Oliver Stone. Now, Oliver Stone's people have come out and denied it, but I got so excited when I read that.
That's a mistake. I think he'd be perfect for it. He would be perfect filmmaker to handle it, not only sensitively, but also to show the ugliness of the story, too. Bar none, my number one choice.
And coming from that 60s generation. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
He's really the last director. He's the only director of that generation who could really give it the treatment it deserves.
Just a real understanding of that time.
Yeah.
Let me take a call. I have another caller here. Taking Care is the screen name that's coming up.
All right.
See if this works. I'm bringing up your line, and it's slow. Hang on. Taking Care, you're on the line. Another one that worked out great.
We're really just like striking aces here.
We're one for four.
Yeah.
Now taking care, let me know in the chat room if you had something to contribute, and I'll pick up your line again because I see that you're in there. I'll take care of your line.
No, Oliver Stone is perfect for that time period.
Yeah.
I think so, too. It's very delicate, though. It's delicate how you handle that. Because Spike Lee got a lot of grief when he did Summer of Sam as well, and so you can imagine what the Manson family would...
Yeah, but Summer of Sam and even though not from a commercial, from a financial, but Summer of Sam is a masterpiece of filmmaking.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an incredible film. And I know a lot of people, a lot of Spike Lee people who hate that film, but I have no problem with that film.
I love that film.
It's a perfect film.
Yeah, no argument here. And I know Chris agrees too. So it would have to be very delicately structured. But Manson is one of the, you know, for better or worse, he's one of the cult figures of the past 40 years.
Stone has to do that just for that line in Natural Born Killers. No one compares to Manson.
Your phone is clicking badly.
I know it's what I do. You know, anything that causes a problem on the show, obviously. You know, Jamie, I'm just that kind of person that just invites that kind of trouble, that technological trouble.
Yeah. The other thing is Woodstock, and I just revisited the film Woodstock. They have a 40th anniversary special edition out that I watched.
Did you listen to the Back by Midnight?
Many hours. Yeah, I edited some stuff for it.
Okay.
But thanks for mentioning his show on mine.
I'm sorry. You know, it's not your show; it's our show. So don't give me that. I it's a self-inflicted wound for me too.
Yes. But I did revisit it, and then we have the Ang Lee film coming out soon.
I want to see that. I think that looks good. People think it's Chuck the Movie Guy, and I don't know if you guys know who Chuck the Movie Guy is. He said, oh, well, they didn't show any realistic concert performances, so it's not very good.
It's not about the concert performance.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I mean, what are you talking about? It's an autobiographical, almost a coming-of-age story where Woodstock is the background. It looks like a very enjoyable film. I mean, I'm sure it's not as good as The Ice Storm or Ride with the Devil, but come on, it looks enjoyable.
I mean, my feeling is it's more about how Woodstock was put together than when it occurred.
Yeah, I mean, when you saw the trailer for that film, did you think, oh, cool, I'm going to see like concert or recreations of The Who and Janis Joplin? Did you think that?
Right. No.
Thank you. I love you guys.
Well, there's Chuck the Movie Guy.
I don't care about him.
So it's pressing it now, and I'm reading all these accounts and an amazing time. But I'm surprised that we haven't had more narrative Woodstock films, actually, but I don't know about that. I mean, I think that's more of a limited – where you could go with it is a little bit more limited than something like Manson or the Moon.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there were, 400,000 people there or something like that? that's a lot of different possible stories,
yeah,
and probably too many possibilities. The best way to do it would probably to be to do something similar anyway to what Ang Lee is doing.
I think what he's doing, at least from the trailer, I haven't seen the movie. I know the reviews have been mixed. It looks like a very charming movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks okay, although it does seem to me that, maybe Ang Lee always seems like this, but it does seem like he's making a conscious effort to try something different.
Yeah.
But then again, like I said, maybe his movies are always like that, because if you really do look at his body of work, it's just very
eclectic.
Sort of schizophrenic and eclectic and all over
the place.
Yeah,
it is.
But it seems par for the course for Ang Lee, because several projects he's tried his hand at doing traditional American genres commenting on traditional American cultural events and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think he's a fascinating filmmaker. I think a lot of interesting things come up when a foreign filmmaker observes American culture in his work.
That's a good point.
Yeah. I don't know how foreign he is these days. He's been here for quite some time, but I guess he is still technically foreign.
Yeah, he is technically. No, I hear what you're saying, Chris, but it is interesting though, that he would take, you see the trailer for Taking Woodstock, and when I guess Khan was the first place I was exposed, when you see that he's associated with the movie, it's like you stand back, take a couple steps back, it's like, okay, what did he see in this that he could do?
Yeah, that's sort of how it's been since he stepped on the scene. I mean, like, when Sense and Sensibility came out. All of a sudden, you look at the director, like, you see him in an interview, and he looks nothing like what you expected him to look like at the time. Like,
you got a good point there, or The Hulk, or, Brokeback Mountain,
Brokeback Mountain. Ice Storm is another one, like,
Do you think Ice Storm is his masterpiece?
I'd say Crouching Tiger would probably be his masterpiece, ironically, because
those two I think are really his big.
I like both those movies. I like his version of the Hulk. I like Ride with the Devil, like you said. I've pretty much, and I like Brokeback Mountain. I've been a fan of everything Ang Lee has done for the most part. So I'm with you. I want to see Taking Woodstock, and I like Dimitri Martin a lot. He's a stand-up comedian.
He's got some promise there, I think, in that film. So
it looks good. It just does sort of look like lighter fare. It doesn't look like anything that's going to be, blowing my skirt up.
No, it's not going to be. It's going to be, like a truffle, if you will.
Right, sort of like Oliver Stone's W, sort of like light fare, not
but
really.
But speaking of Oliver Stone, and we all like Oliver Stone a lot on the show, maybe more than Jason O'Brien likes Oliver Stone, would you welcome, in the years to come, if he went back and did the second term of W, would you welcome that? Would anyone even care, I think, is the first question. But
yeah, I was about to say, I wouldn't really be interested in it. And I actually heard on Bill Maher, I think he touched on it, he said he pretty much didn't want to do that.
Right. I remember that, yeah.
Well, he was specifically talking about the Reagan movie. He didn't want to make a Reagan movie because he felt like he was such a similar character to George Bush. But obviously that would stand true to the second half of the Bush presidency.
That's very true. I just curious.
Part of it, I think it would be tougher to make in what he described as a souffle. That's how he described his W movie. Sort of light and fluffy and not too serious. It would be a little, that was easy enough to do with the upcoming, the raising of George Bush and, sort of rising of George Bush and the early part of his presidency. It would be a little bit tougher to tackle some of the later stuff.
Yeah, well, you do Katrina, that's going to be very tough.
Yeah. Katrina, Abu.
Yeah, Bray. And I didn't necessarily appreciate a light and fluffy and not too serious look at Bush to begin with W. So.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah,
I got to
be honest, it didn't work quite so well, but...
we have two lists that Entertainment Weekly, they're in love with their lists.
They've become like the Washingtonian, this is a big thing this week because the Washingtonian magazine let go of their editor who was, big on these lists. So what are the lists from Entertainment Weekly?
Well, we have two choices. Tell me which one you
want
to go through.
Well, you have you're the mastermind here. What are the lists?
We have the 20 top horror films since 1989, or we have 35 unforgettable nude scenes.
Let's do the horror film, because the nude scenes,
yeah.
I'm gonna have to go on the. You don't want to do that, Jamie, because you could lose sponsors.
I can't believe we have a show hosted by three males and we're going for horror films over nude scenes. All right, wait.
What are the nude scenes? All right, name me the first nude scene, okay?
It's a radio show, though. It's not a TV show.
Wait, before.
You don't think we could offer oral stimulation?
I can do that with no problem, but what's the first nude scene? Let's just, before we do anything, what's the first nude scene?
The proposal. So, okay.
Oh, Jesus Christ, go to the horror films.
Number 20 in the 20 top horror films of the past 20 years, 1989 to today, Dead Alive.
Okay.
That's a perfectly respectable choice.
I'm going to, you know, fall on my sword for that one, sure.
Number 19 is a little odd. I never thought of this as a horror film, but Darkman.
Darkman?
I can
yeah.
see it because of Sam Raimi, but I wouldn't categorize it as a horror film.
Number 18, which there's some people that love this movie, and there's some people that just loathed it when it came out. Event Horizon.
Yeah, there are people. That movie does have a pretty loyal following.
It has a loyal following. Sam Neill goes nuts. I guess that's great, but I, you know, a lot of people like to say, oh, it's the thinking person's film that Paul S. W. Anderson was meaning to make his whole life. It's just not that good.
No, I can't say I was ever that nuts about it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I just can't get into it.
Number 17, there's a made-for-Danish television movie, Lars von Trier. It's a soap opera called The Kingdom.
Oh, yeah, that's a big deal.
Number 16, which would be my number one, actually, is their 16, is The Descent.
That would be up there. I can't, yeah. Oh, God, you mean we have 15 more to go?
Yeah, I can imagine that there's 15 better horror films of the past 20 years than The Descent.
Oh, God, let's just go, well, Jamie. You're really trying to give me a hard
strangely
time.
Strangely enough, horror is one of those genres that you actually can have kind of a conversation with lots of different movies.
Yeah.
Is it a horror movie? Is it not a horror movie? So,
yeah.
Kind of
like
a funny
one.
Genre like that.
Like number 15, Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah. See,
yeah,
that's
I mean, but that's a comedy, though. But I would put The Descent well above that, though.
It is a comedy. I agree with you, Jerry, but actually, I think more than just being a comedy, it is a zombie movie, and zombie movies, by their very nature, are horror. So it took a horror genre and sort of did something different with it.
Okay,
but.
No, I agree with you, Chris. I just thought, you know, in my mind, The Descent would be higher up on this list. So this is what.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Chris,
you and I saw
The Descent together, Chris, and we both were like, "This works."
And that's a perfect example. Yeah, if you want to watch, if you put The Descent in, you're not looking for a laugh. You're looking for a horror movie.
Yeah.
If you put in Shaun of the Dead, chances are you're not looking for a horror movie. Chances are you want to laugh because it's more of a funny movie. So, yeah, I don't know how much of a horror movie that is. Second thought, really.
Number 14. Hostel 2.
Huh? Look, Hostel, you know, 2. I am sure that Inglourious Basterds is going to make me feel proud to be a Jew once again, thanks to Quentin Tarantino, because of Eli Roth's performance. But Hostel 2? Okay. Is Cabin Fever or Hostel 1 on this list?
An Eli Roth splatter sequel, wealthy businessmen make bids to travel to Slovakia, where in a network of dungeons hidden inside an abandoned factory, the top bidder will murder the victim he has bought. Calling up echoes of the sex trafficking industry, Roth isn't just whipping up a blood-smeared megaplex hellhole. He's asking, in a world of global depravity, where anyone can buy anything, is homicide for kicks for the right price really such a huge leap? So they see it as a message film.
Say what you want about, you know, I am one of the defenders of the Hostel movies and of the Saw movies to a certain extent. And I did too, and I actually like the second one. But say what you will about these movies, they do work. Whether or not you like them, whether or not you think that it's good filmmaking, it's impossible to sit through it without feeling very, very dirty and without feeling actually quite scared. They're actually quite chilling.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Chris, there. I agree with that.
In the same way that Last House on the Left, the original Last House on the Left was, or I Spit on Your Grave, or Cannibal Holocaust, or something like that. In that exact same way, they sort of feel very, very dirty, and I shouldn't be watching this kind of
thing. Yeah, but it's not the, from Eli Roth, it's not the first film that I would have come up with.
I like Cabin Fever better than either of the Hostel movies, so, you know.
Yeah.
Number 13 is... Misery.
Mm.
Again,
okay.
Would you? I mean, it's Stephen King. It's
got
a psychotic woman.
Yeah, I put it on there. Yeah, I mean, but what bugs me is what's further along this list, Jamie. It's like, yeah. You know, my heart is racing now. You might be responsible for like a ER visit later, but okay.
Number 12 is From Hell.
The Hughes Brothers thing of the Alan Moore.
The Hughes Brothers,
yeah. I just watched that the other day, actually.
I like it, but I don't, you know, it's funny. I don't consider that, okay, I'm obviously an old man. I'm going to shut up now.
Well, no, I agree. Not only do I not consider it a horror movie, I also don't consider it to be a movie that works particularly well. And I like the Hughes Brothers, but I'm surprised that is on this list. I'm certainly surprised it's as high up as it is.
Did Aaron put this list together?
Number 11 is Planet Terror.
Planet Terror.
Yeah, okay, that I would put that on there, sure.
Okay.
Better than The Descent.
No. The Descent, I mean, this is what I have a problem with. The Descent was so far back that it really makes these choices so far lame.
Yeah. Number 10, Ringu.
They're going with the Japanese version, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can see that to an extent.
This is surprising. Number 9, Alien 3.
Oh, well,
I definitely say that's a little bit of revisionist history there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, come on. I'm with Chris here. Come on. What the fuck's up with that? I mean,
people want to look for a David Fincher movie, and that's probably the closest thing he's made to a horror movie. So, and don't get me wrong, I'm a defender of Alien 3.
I like it,
and if I were making this list, it would probably be on there. But I'd say that's revisionist history because when it came out, no one liked it, and for years, people have talked about how much it sucked.
Fincher
has a cult following, and people want to say that that's one of the greatest horror movies. I don't think so. And in fact, I don't know which version they're talking about here, but if it's the theatrical version, I say shenanigans because the director's cut or his original... The original version that they showed at the studios is a much, much better movie, works a lot better than the theatrical version.
Yeah.
And it's quite different, actually. It is one of those director's cuts that is actually quite different.
Yeah.
Number 8. Chris, you'll like this. Drag Me to Hell.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, it should be on there, without a doubt.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Number 7. The Sixth Sense. Again, I don't think horror necessarily, but...
No, a little bit of genre.
Yeah,
I
don't know.
I guess.
The Happening's not on there, is it?
I don't know. I haven't got to the bottom of the list yet.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
No, we're not talking about it's not the most horrific acting since 1989.
Okay, yeah, I know. I mean, really. Yeah.
Number 6 is... What Lies Beneath?
What?
Yeah.
You're gonna put that ahead of The Descent?
That movie's not good. It's not a good movie. It's really not. In fact, it wasn't a great movie when it came out. No one really thought that was a great movie when it came out.
Yeah.
I understand that it's on cable every 3 hours. You can always turn on the TV and find
out. Tentacles.
But it's not that good. And
no,
it's not. Seeing it on cable every day does not make it that good.
Right. Okay, number 5, this is interesting, too, that they chose this one, 28 Weeks Later.
Why that one?
Why not Days? I mean, I like Weeks Later, but...
No.
But who put this together? Did the guy's stepson put this together? Who was like
richer, darker, crazier, and even scarier than 28 Days Later. Juan Carlos Fernandillo's Jittery Shocker is a piece of visionary apocalyptic zombie.
A Day with My Father is darker than that. I mean, come on. I mean, all right. This is really sad.
Number four. Probably, like, definitely one of the most influential, for better or worse, of the past 20 years, Scream.
Yeah. But can I need to ask a question to everyone on this, in our group here on our show. This was originally a comedy, a satire, when it came out. When did it become, because it made fun of all the films that I grew up on in the 80s.
Yeah, you're forgetting that it scared stupid people.
Yeah,
so.
Well, so does the healthcare debate, too, but I mean...
but seriously, no, it did. Jamie and I worked in a theater at the time, and it scared the shit out of people. I didn't find it to be a particularly scary movie, but people kept
weren't
coming back.
Weren't you laughing, Chris?
I agree with you, Jerry. I agree. I think the movie at the time worked mostly on a comedic level, and I think it still works mostly on a comedic level. People were scared by it.
Just to give everyone a teaser before we get to the top three.
Oh my God!
Horror films of the past 20 years, according to Entertainment Weekly, and their infinite wisdom. Wednesday night, we're going to welcome Bobcat Goldthwait. You guys know him as comedian and actor, and he's
Police
a director
Academy
now.
Films.
Yeah, he's a director now. Made a really interesting movie starring Robin Williams called World's Greatest Dad. He'll be talking about that, and then we'll welcome the director of a new documentary called Art and Copy, which is another fascinating movie. It's a documentary about the advertising world.
Wow. Okay.
That's Wednesday night.
That ties into Mad Men tonight.
Yeah, that was my purpose. Number three is the Blair Witch Project.
That deserves to be on there. I don't know if it deserves to be ahead of The Descent, but it deserves to be on this list without a doubt and high up there.
Yeah.
Now, what would your guess be as to what's missing in the top two here?
Oh, shit.
That's tough. I have one, but I feel like I wonder if it's even going to be on this list because it wasn't a huge hit or anything. But I would like – there's two that come to mind. Now, obviously, everyone argues whether or not Silence of the Lambs is a horror movie. I personally consider it to be a horror movie.
It should be on the list. It really.
I would put that on the list, and the other slot. I'm sure I'm forgetting something else, but I am quite fond of Alejandro Amenábar's The Others.
Those two. I'm with you, Chris, on both of those.
Okay.
Right, is it neither one of those? Is it neither one?
Number two is The Silence of the Lambs.
Okay, thank God.
Interesting.
Okay, so far we have a couple that we agree should be on this list. We have The Descent, we have Blair Witch.
I have one I want to pick if it's not the other.
So what would be above all of those?
The Orphanage?
All of those. No, it can't be The Orphanage.
No, but The Orphanage was very good, but I just don't give Entertainment Weekly the... I mean, it's Scream and some of the...
Tell me it's not Pan's Labyrinth.
Well, wait, you guys don't like Pan's... Well, it wouldn't be... That's Pan's Labyrinth isn't the right... This isn't the right genre. It's not a horror film.
Well, but neither is several of these other movies that have been
I know,
out
but
there.
Pan's Labyrinth is, I think, one of the best movies of this decade. But
I like it, too. I just feel like I just don't want it to be number one on this list.
No, it shouldn't be a horror film. No. Oh, God, what is it, Jamie? Just out with it.
My computer's frozen. Hang on.
Oh, shit. That's been your excuse for everything lately, my computer.
I'm sorry. It's frozen. I don't know what's missing from this list so far.
The Brown Bunny?
Yeah. G.I. Joe, maybe. No. Okay, hang on, it's going to load. Give it a second. The number one choice, this might not be very bad. I've seen this movie, I'm sure we have too. Audition.
No, I have no problem with that.
Yeah, Audition is pretty fucking scary.
It's you know what's really funny is it having seen a lot of films by this director, that's his most restrained film.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting as for a Mike movie, his movies are usually so over the top and so sort of bombastic that this movie I've always been quite pleased that no one ever tried to remake this, although the decade is young.
Yeah.
So I don't think it would work, but then I think people probably would have made that argument for The Ring or for any of the other shitty movies that they remade.
Yeah.
I am glad that they never remade this, although I think one of the things that works best about it is no one's ever fucking heard of it. So whenever you do finally see everything that happens comes as quite a surprise.
Yeah.
And that's how it worked for me. Although I'm disappointed that The Others isn't on this list.
That The Others isn't on the list and that the Descent is not much higher is very disappointing. But for a Miki film, this is his most restrained film. He doesn't go overboard, which he does in every other film of his. This is that one time he doesn't.
Yeah, there's a couple moments where he goes overboard,
like The Others, though, that he does the other films. This is, let's be very honest, this is his most restrained.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I did see Audition, and when you're a filmmaker that is considered his most restrained, when you show the cutting off of feet and the eating of vomit and all that kind of stuff, that really says something.
No, it does, because if you watch, like, the Dead Alive trilogy or his Yakuza films or his other horror films, this man is obsessed with fluids. And The Audition doesn't... I mean, don't get the where they kill the dog, I was horrified. But, that's the number one film, though, from Entertainment Weekly?
Yeah.
Did they have... Did someone take over the guest editor's spot or something? I just wouldn't put this in their ball court, really.
No,
yeah. Well, especially looking at the rest of the list, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, was it like, hey, send your nephew that you hate to work day? I mean.
So, what else is going on, guys? That's an exciting list. What would we put as our top nude scenes of all time? Forget about Entertainment Weekly's list. Oh, let the right one in. Good point in the chat room there.
What about that? What about, and there's also the Korean.
As a nude scene or a horror film?
Jamie, you're confusing me.
Sorry.
Yeah. The truth comes out, Jamie.
Yeah, really. Which one is it? I mean, you got to pick one or the other.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Okay, so it's the best nude scene. Chris, what are your favorite nude scenes?
What kind of nude are we talking about? What are we talking about?
Yeah, like, really, man. That's like really broad.
Yeah.
I'm looking for a broad that's in the nude.
The shower scene in Stripes, anything in the movie we talked about last week, obviously, Last Tango in Paris, or anything in the Porky's films, or I could go on and on. Does this include, like, movies made in the 818 area code?
Yeah. I don't want to sound like a total, like a half a fag or something, but, I don't remember the nude scenes from movies. Don't get me wrong, whenever a chick shows off her hooter in a movie, I'm down with it, but it's not the kind of thing that sticks in my mind.
Yeah, I mean,
really.
I'm not like Mr. Skin Man. I don't have encyclopedic knowledge of this.
I had no idea I would stir up such debate when I just asked favorite nude
scenes. No, but I mean, but like, there's like a lot of Chasey Lane movies I like and a lot of, never mind. But I mean,
I'm talking about legitimate theatrical movies. When you think of an actress that disrobed,
mm-hmm.
what are the images that come to your mind from those movies?
Uma Thurman, Mad Dog and Glory.
Okay.
Mm.
All right. And Henry and June.
Okay.
God, look at this. Listen to the emptiness out there.
Uma Thurman, okay.
Uma Thurman, and obviously the other actress, but I don't think she's done any nude scenes with Zoe Dashian now, but we won't go there.
Chris, any ideas?
I gotta be honest, no. Like, none even really spring to mind. Like, the kind of stuff that springs to mind is, obviously the Basic Instinct and stuff like that, or when Jamie Lee Curtis showed off her like, the famous ones are what spring to mind, not necessarily something that I found.
Right,
right.
Or mm-hmm. like that.
Halle Berry stuff. Yeah.
In Swordfish.
And Swordfish. Like, if I were to name a couple of them, it wouldn't necessarily be the ones that gave me the hardest boner, it's not necessarily because Sharon Stone on Crossing Her Legs in Basic Instinct makes my dick cut glass. It's just me.
it's really funny. That scene doesn't do anything for anybody anymore. And I watched Casino last night, but,
it's just not the kind of thing that really does it.
Yeah, but you caught us off guard, Duval.
Yeah.
Well, that was a worthwhile topic.
That was funny.
You know what is a nude scene that sticks out in my mind? It's the nude scene that what's her name from Frozen River had in Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada.
Oh, yeah, man. He's got a good point, man.
When she's banging Dwight Yoakam and he can't get a hard on, and all of a sudden she says maybe he
Melissa
should try Viagra. They're both sitting there naked on the couch, and he says maybe you should try Viagra, and Dwight Yoakam says, I'll turn truck stop queer giving blowjobs before I try that shit.
That's right.
That's a great movie.
Out to me is when it, like, sort of works in the scene. I don't want to sound like half a fag, but it doesn't really do anything for me.
And there's nothing wrong with sounding like that or being like that. But how about stuff like looking at it from a different point of view? How about stuff like Bad Lieutenant?
Mm. Oh, where he goes, like, you know.
Yeah.
I
mean,
you know,
we see so little, not that I'm begging for it or anything, but there has been this double standard, and there's a couple of actors that are brave enough to, you know, show full frontal, which is really shocking because you never see it. You never expect to see something like that.
I got yelled at Thanksgiving dinner for I did the moaning sequence, you know, the audio of that scene. I got yelled at Thanksgiving, and the woman told me to stop.
Oh, what do you mean, pulling the car over?
No, of like, you know, where he, you know, where he's in front of the nun, you know, and he, you know, that scene where.
Oh,
he,
right. Okay.
I used to be able to do that, but I can't do it anymore because the woman was like, could you stop that? I can't eat.
Well, you should take that on America's Got Talent or something. And there's also stuff like in terms of male, like. I can't believe I'm talking about this like I'm the expert on it or something.
I can't believe it.
I gotta go.
Like Bruce Willis in The Color of Night, I remember, which is a terrible movie.
Terrible movie, but that was his comeback film for that year.
Well, I could see why. And then there's...
I emphasize the word come, but I mean...
And then there's the...
Are we really talking about the great cock exposure?
I hope, Chris... This thing is just going downhill.
And there's John Malkovich in The Sheltering Sky.
God, you make me... I wanted to watch it so badly after we talked to Doug Pratt, but okay.
But there's also a great nude scene from some kind of Arabic dancer that disrobes for him in The Sheltering
mm-hmm.
Sky.
Yeah, that's right. Right. Yeah.
I got one for you, Jamie. I know one that'll really get you moaning. The love scene in Desperado.
That's right. I mean, Salma Hayek has always been my number one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it doesn't get much better than that.
Anything with Salma Hayek, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, that's good. This has been a constructive conversation.
It has been. It's one of the greatest we've ever had.
All right.
Upsetting.
Talk about something else while my computer loads my switchboard page so I can play this closing music.
What is
music.
It with your computer? Like, are you being controlled by Skynet or something? I mean...
I have no idea.
Pictures of Bruce Willis's cock from Color of Night. And
okay, what is this thing you wanted us to talk about and besides Bruce Willis's cock?
What? What are you talking about? I want to fill up some time here. What do you guys want to say?
Well, I want to say that I think that this Friday will be the greatest event in motion picture history until at least the following week. But no, I wanted to say, don't you guys find it kind of funny that, you know, Inglourious Basterds comes out, but Robert Rodriguez's on film Shorts comes out the same day?
It is funny that they have movies opening on the same day.
And you see so little of Shorts, if anything. Seriously, there's no word on this movie.
No, but as a friend of mine said, you know, you're Rodriguez, you know, you've made some really great films. God forbid you're hit by a bus or something. Do you really want Shorts to be your last film?
Yeah, well, he's always done that, though. He's always sort of switched back and forth from making
that's true.
Movies for adults, and then even the... you know, Shark Boy and Lava Girl, when the first Spy Kids movie came out, it was sort of
the first Spy Kids is a good movie, though, I think.
I'm not saying it's not, but there was very little hype for those movies.
Yeah.
Kids just sort of intuitively recognized that it was cool filmmaking, and it wasn't.
I can't believe we've gone from the conversation we had before to kids' movies.
But that's what makes our show so great, Dave.
It's beautiful.
It's
beautiful.
The genius of our show that we can go from... Chasey Lane to Shorts. I mean, come
on. we go from Bruce Willis The Color of Night to Shorts, which that's versatile.
Yeah.
From long to short.
Ironically, when Bruce Willis is wearing shorts, you can still see his cock.
Wow. Okay. There we go, folks.
Man, what has happened to this
Bruce
show?
Willis, what does everyone think of his new film, Surrogates?
Yeah,
my sentiments exactly.
I got to go the other way. I got to be honest. I think it's an exciting trailer. I don't think it looks like anything too terribly original. But Jonathan Mostow, let's not forget, like, he's capable of making
Breakdown.
Breakdown. U-571, not a bad movie.
No, that's
and
true.
The truth is, Terminator 3, although we remember it quite poorly, it's starting to look a hell of a lot better these days after having seen Terminator Salvation.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that, Chris. I just knew that was coming.
Not only that, but when I saw it, it really wasn't such a bad movie. I mean, it's not as good as the first two, obviously, but, you know, you're following James Cameron's footsteps. It wasn't a totally awful movie.
No, it has a lot of the good. It's like Arnold's, like swan song, if you will.
Yeah, plus there is something very comforting about just watching a Bruce Willis badass action movie.
I hadn't seen a trailer until about like 2 weeks ago, so I was just curious what everyone thought of it.
Yeah, it doesn't look so bad. I don't.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be his Johnny Mnemonic. The website for Roman Polanski's new film, The Ghost, is up.
That's a good book.
It's interesting, yeah. You hear the title, and I thought it would be another kind of supernatural thing.
No. It's about, like, Blair's speechwriter and all that. And it's a good,
yeah.
It's a really good thriller by Robert Harris. So I expect good things from it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I'm excited about another Polanski movie. Greg, who's in it? Ewan McGregor and Pierce Brosnan are in
it.
Oh,
dude, that's an awesome cast.
Yeah. And there's always something special with Polanski. It's like when you hear like a great actor is doing a Polanski film, like Harrison Ford is doing a Polanski film, because it almost seems like when you do Polanski's work, like you're working for the cage undercover or something. It has to
be
like a covert operation. You fly to the secret location. I know that's not true, but you know, he's kind of an infamous figure, so
yeah.
It's always exciting dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it. I think that's it.
Okay. We got a great show on Wednesday, though, with Bobcat.
Yes, we do.
And we have next Sunday, though, I don't think we can, we have the big Casino tribute with Frank Vincent.
We had to move it because we were going to do Casino this Wednesday, but we had the movies that opened Friday and guests speaking about them, so we had to put those on Wednesday. But, yeah, that conversation with Frank Vincent's awesome, and that'll happen next Sunday. Are you working next Sunday, Chris?
I believe I am, actually. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry, man.
No, it's okay. I'll have to download it and listen to it later.
I appreciate that, man. But we're going to miss your participation.
We will.
Well, if it's still going on when I get out, then...
Call in.
I'll give a call. Give a call and give some thoughts about it. We'll see.
All right, yo. Other new classics. What would you choose as a classic and a new classic, Chris? I want your input.
As a new classic?
Yeah, because Casino and Heat are our new classics, and then you have Inside the Classic series, which are older movies and pre-1980s movies.
I have my thing made up, but I want to hear Chris's first because it's more important.
Huh. Well, gee, that's kind of putting me right on the spot there. But let me think quick. Give me 10 seconds here.
All right.
Let's see. Starting
Jerry,
now.
You want Jerry to go? Jerry, you go first. Give Chris a little time to think.
My classics, The Last Wave, new classics, Out of Sight.
That's a good one.
That was pretty good. I just made that up.
That's a very good one.
Thank you.
Not bad. Not bad at all. Jesus Christ. Really putting me on the spot here.
Superstar?
Wait, we could do that.
As far as classics go, I think it's about time we start calling something like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's time
we start calling that
a classic.
Right.
And as far as the new classics go, I might have to go for a little bit something like, I don't know, something like Jackie Brown, actually.
Yes!
Would not be a bad movie to talk about.
I'm all for that. I've been wanting to talk about that for a long time.
If not Jackie Brown, then one of the other Tarantino films, like Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction. I think it's perfectly obvious that those three movies, certainly the first two, we're going to be talking about for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, I had thoughts, and we have a minute left. I had thoughts about, for older classics, I'd like to do something on M, or I got to think more about older classics. But the new classics, Jerry and I talked about Fearless.
Fearless,
talked about,
I think, is a good one, I think.
Accidental Tourists. You know, there's also, you know, some people really love Mosquito Coast, and that came to my mind the other day. I have a lot of ideas for new classics more so than classics for some reason.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Those are all great choices.
Yeah, so that should be interesting. So tune into our blogs and everything. We'll have a website up in the next month, moviegeeksunited.net. So be on the lookout for that. Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night, everyone.